Hello and welcome to a bonus solving history. I'm Emily.
And I'm Gemma. Given that it's spooky season, we thought it was a good time to talk about witches. So grab your potion of choice and buckle in as we discuss the case of the last woman in Britain to be tried as a witch, Helen Duncan, also known as the Blitz Witch.
Wait, do you mean like the Blitz is in World War II, the Blitz?
One and the same. The witch trials that gripped Europe and America were over by the 1750s. But it was not the last time that a woman would be arrested, charged, and convicted for the crime of being a witch. In 1943, Helen Duncan was convicted under the Witchcraft Act of 1735 and sentenced to 9 months in Holloway Prison. The question for this podcast is a simple one. Was she really a witch?
Okay, let's start off with finding out some more about Helen.
Born Victoria Helen McCree McFarlane on the 25th of November 1897 in Callander, Scotland, Helen was said to have exhibited, quote, psychic abilities from a very young age. One story claims that whilst at school, Helen's teacher wrote some questions on the blackboard for the children to answer on their slates. Not knowing the answers, Helen, quote, prayed for help and the answers appeared on her slate. When questioned by the teacher, Helen could not explain how the answers appeared there, nor how they were written in handwriting that wasn't her own.
What did her parents say about that?
Both of her parents had female relations with the gift, and so were initially unconcerned and believed that Helen would simply grow out of it. However, her abilities grew stronger, and eventually her mother took her to a local doctor to check if there was anything physically wrong. Nothing could be found. However, whilst there, Helen supposedly warned the doctor not to go out that night. Advice he ignored, and that night his car skidded off the road in a snowstorm, claiming his life. This led the local Presbyterian minister to accuse Helen of, quote, consorting with the devil. And so, faced with growing hostility and a lack of employment opportunities, she had moved away from the home by the age of 16.
Where did she go to then?
It's not clear exactly where she went, but by the outbreak of World War I, she was living and working in Dundee, first in a munitions factory and then later as a nurse. Whilst working as a nurse, Helen was introduced to her future husband, Henry Duncan. Henry had been invalided out of the army due to a damaged valve in his heart caused by rheumatic fever and worked as a cabinet maker. The two married in 1916.
What did he make of her gifts? I'm assuming that she told him.
She did, and he was supportive of her gifts and encouraged her to use them, especially as family finances became strained. Although Helen wanted to support her six children, she was initially wary of sharing her talents owing to her early experiences. I mean, who could blame her? Eventually, the need for money and Helen's desire to help people, quote, seeking comfort after the war, soon changed her mind. By the mid-1920s, her skills were in demand, and each morning the post would bring requests for sittings and invitations for Helen to visit and hold seances, for which she would then receive a small fee.
Do we know how her gifts worked?
Well, it was reported that she would go into a deep trance and communicate with those that had passed away, but her skills seemed to grow the more she used them. During one of her trances, quote, the voice of a Dr. Williams materialized and told Henry that his wife had the potential to materialize these spirits. Henry was, of course, excited by this and persuaded Helen to hold experimental seances with neighbors and friends as sitters.
How did those go?
Well, they were said to be, quote, unpredictable and even frightening at times, but Henry learned from Dr. Williams that, quote, saying a prayer at the start and keeping a Bible to hand would both develop his wife's talents and keep both her and the audience safe. Henry even made a cabinet for Helen to sit inside, believing it would act as a harness for her powers, allowing spirits to materialize and appear to those in attendance, which it did to the amazement of those in the audience. Helen is said to have begun to produce ectoplasm from her mouth and nostrils. And those who witnessed it firsthand described it as a magical mist or living cobweb, which glowed bright white and appeared as if it had a life of its own. This new talent saw Helen's popularity increase. The Scottish spiritist Spiritualist Society in Edinburgh invited Helen to give regular séances to their members. They were so impressed by Helen that they presented her with a certificate endorsing her talent. However, when Helen and Henry, who was by this point acting as Helen's manager, learned how much the sitters were paid to attend the séances compared to how little they were paid, they refused to be exploited, and this began a dispute between the spiritualist organisation and Helen that continued throughout her life.
Were Helen's skills tested in any way?
Yes, so Henry was so confident in Helen's abilities that in 1931 he agreed to allow Mr. Harry Bryce to witness a séance and test Helen's abilities. Price, who was a prolific author and media personality, had authored several books on the supernatural. Price was determined to prove Helen a fraud, and during their first meeting announced that he thought all mediums were, quote, guilty of fraud until proven genuine. During a controlled test séance, he took samples of ectoplasm, which dissipated in the bottle before they could be examined, and he concluded that the spirits Helen produced were, quote, no more than trickery created with a sheet of cheesecloth. However, this is disputed by believers who argue that Helen was examined before every sitting, during which it was confirmed that no piece of cloth was concealed about or inside her body. In response, Price claimed Helen regurgitated the cheesecloth and that her refusal to be x-rayed was because she had a second stomach. His theories gained popularity and were in part responsible for Helen's first brush with the law. When during a séance in Edinburgh, when a member of the audience grabbed one of Helen's spirit guides known as Peggy, this led to a commotion and resulted in the police being called. The audience member claimed that the spirit, which manifested, was an undervest. In response, Helen claimed the garment had been stolen from her travelling bag and was being abused in an attempt to discredit her. When offered the chance to bring charges, Helen refused. However, Helen was accused of a fray and fraud, to which she pleaded not guilty. Despite there having been eight people present at the séance, just three appeared for the prosecution. The audience member herself admitted that at the same time the spirit guide was talking, Helen could also be heard breathing deeply whilst in a trance. Nobody disputed that several spirits had appeared and spoke, and when the disturbance occurred, Helen was seen to be sitting behind the cabinet before she was woken out of her trance. Testifying for the defence, Dr. Marguerite Link Hutchinson, who examined the naked Helen before the séance and supervised it as she dressed in her black séance garments. When shown the vest and asked if Helen could have used it to replicate the young spirit guide Peggy, she replied, quote, it would have been impossible to produce anything like what was seen using a garment like that. She also dismissed Price's regurgitation theory, stating that Helen could not have regurgitated the amount of material required to produce the spirits, as she had eaten with Helen and remained with her until the séance. Therefore, it would have been impossible for Helen to regurgitate the material without also vomiting up the meal. Despite the weak evidence and her strong defence, Helen was found guilty and given a 10-shilling fine, which is about £25 in today's money.
Did that and the fine see her popularity decrease?
No, despite the court case, her popularity actually continued to grow. And by the 1940s, she was travelling all around the UK, holding hundreds of séances in spiritualist churches and even in homes. The outbreak of World War II saw the demand for her services increase even more. And in 1941, Helen would hold two séances that were to have serious repercussions.
What happened?
Well, the first took place in Edinburgh on the 24th of May 1941. In attendance was Brigadier Firebrace, and during the séance, Helen's spirit guides made a number of claims. First, that a battleship had just been sunk. Second, that Russia would enter the war on the side of the Allies, something which at the time seemed highly unlikely. And lastly, that the war would end with two big bangs. After leaving the séance, the brigadier returned home and listened to the news, wanting to know if a battleship had indeed been sunk, but there was no mention of it. And so he rang the Admiralty and the official denied it. Now, you might think that's kind of the end of it, but the following morning, the same official rang Brigadier Firebrace back and confirmed that HMS Hood had been sunk by the Bismarck, and asked how he had the information before some sections of the Admiralty had heard the news. Firebrace told him about Helen and the events of the seance. Now, whether they believed him or not, it put Helen on their radar.
I mean, first of all, Firebrace is a name. Brigadier Firebrace, I love that. Second of all, I can't imagine that being on their radar was probably where she wanted to be.
No, not at all. So the second seance of consequence took place in the November of 1941, when Helen had a seance in Portsmouth, the home of the Royal Navy. During the seance, the spirit of a sailor, dressed in his uniform, complete with the name HMS Barham on his cap band, appeared. Those in attendance, including his mother, heard him say that his ship had been sunk with great loss of life, including his own. Now, as you can imagine, his mother was shocked by this. Allegedly replied that it could not be true, she had not been notified, to which the spirit of the sailor claimed, quote, she would be in 3 weeks' time before fading away. Now, as any mother would be, she was so concerned for her son that she contacted the Admiralty, who sent two officials round to question her. The Admiralty knew through Enigma machine communications, intercepted at Bletchley Park, that the Germans thought only minor damage had been done to HMS Barham, when the truth was that the ship had been blown up a few minutes after being hit by a U-boat torpedo. The Royal Navy wanted the Germans to continue thinking that HMS Barham was still a threat in the Mediterranean. As such, they'd gone to great lengths to keep the sinking from the public and did not initially announce the sinking until late January 1942. Despite this, due to Helen's seance rumours of HMS Barham sinking, began to spread around Portsmouth. Although they took no action at the time, there were suggestions among the authorities that Helen was a potential security risk, especially as they were in the midst of planning D-Day.
What's that got to do with Helen?
Well, by 1944, D-Day was being planned at Southwick House near Portsmouth, and as we know, security was paramount.
Okay, but it's not like she would have known what they were planning.
Well, here's the thing. Training for D-Day had not got off to the best start, leading to the deaths of a number of troops. And as we have seen, Helen's seances had a worrying habit of giving out military information which wasn't public knowledge, leading those in charge to worry that the spirit of one of these soldiers could appear at a seance and tell the sitters how and where they died, from which a sitter might make an educated guess as to when and where the invasion was to take place.
Okay, I mean, when you put it like that, I can kind of see how that would be worrying. So what did they do?
Chief Constable of West Hampshire Police decided that a better safe than sorry policy was the best course of action. And for the sake of the soldiers preparing to storm the French coast, Helen needed to be kept out of the way by any means necessary. On January 19th, 1944, Helen was holding a seance above a chemist shop in Portsmouth when the police arrived and arrested her under Section 4 of the Vagrancy Act 1824. Such was Helen's fame, the BBC actually interrupted coverage of the Russian advances on the Eastern Front to announce news of her arrest. The charge was changed to contravening the Witchcraft Act 1735, which covered, quote, fraudulent spiritual activity and needed to be tried before a jury.
So did the police find any evidence at the seance that she was faking?
No, and as such, the case was based on the logic that Helen must have pretended to conjure up the spirits of the dead as no such thing existed. Therefore, to prove her innocence, Helen would have to prove the existence of life after death.
I mean, you know, sounds pretty simple, to be honest. Don't really need much evidence for that, do we?
I mean, you would think so. The trial began on the 3rd of March and lasted for a month, ending on the 3rd of April 1944, and was presided over by Judge Dodson. Helen's defence barrister was himself a spiritualist and saw the trial as an opportunity to promote spiritualism. And his strategy was simple. Let Helen hold a seance in the court and let everyone present, including the jurors, see the proof with their own eyes. However, the judge initially rejected this request. The case made against Helen was weak and unconvincing, with the prosecution calling only five witnesses, two of which were policemen involved in her arrest. The defence, however, produced 49 witnesses, including a district sessions judge, a reverend, a doctor, a wing commander, and a theatre critic. Worn down by the number of defence witnesses, the judge offered the jury a demonstration of a seance should it help them make a decision about Helen's guilt or innocence. However, they decline.
I mean, they've been offered that up on a plate. Surely, you'd want to know, you'd want to test it out.
I mean, the short answer as to why they didn't is we don't know. The slightly longer one is that the jury had been brought to London from Portsmouth. As such, they were away from their families and they were eager to return home, especially as the trial was continually interrupted by bombing. Unsurprisingly, Helen was found guilty, and in his determination to get her the maximum possible prison sentence, the chief constable described her as, quote, a national pest and unmitigated humbug, and divulged that she had disclosed the sinking of two ships before they were public knowledge.
Hang on, so what you're saying is she was guilty of pretending to conjure up spirits whilst also being condemned for being so accurate that she was a threat to national security.
Impressive, right? Whatever the rationale, Helen was shown no mercy and was sentenced to 9 months in Holloway Prison and her appeal rejected. Her sentence was reduced to 6 months and she was released on the 22nd of September 1944.
What did she do after she was released?
Upon her release, Helen vowed to stop conducting seances, but the loss of life suffered during the Second World War saw demand for her services increase. And Helen, who had always wanted to help people, found that she could not ignore the requests. In 1951, the Witchcraft Act was repealed and replaced with the Fraudulent Mediums Act. And 3 years later, spiritualism was officially recognised as a legitimate religion by an Act of Parliament. Although it was a recognised religion, in 1956, another of Helen's seances was raided by the police, who woke Helen from her trance, which spiritualists believe to be dangerous as it causes the ectoplasm to return to the medium's body too quickly, which can cause the medium immense pain and even lead to death. When examined by a doctor after her abrupt wake-up call, Helen had two second-degree burns the size of saucers on her stomach and breast, which caused her severe pain. And she was rushed to the hospital, but the burns never healed, and sadly, she passed away just 5 weeks after the police raid on December the 6th, 1956. So, was Helen a witch?
It's a bit of a weird one, isn't it?
Mm.
Because I don't think you can both be prosecuted for being a fraud and also being annoyingly accurate. It's strange. And also
Yeah.
the whole burn thing as well is really weird. Like at the end, that in itself is a little bit strange. I feel like you can kind of pick holes in stories about spirits appearing and all that kind of stuff as being like smoke and mirrors things. But actual burns is really strange.
Yeah, I'm not sure which, I know she was called the Blitz Witch. Not sure which is the right title for her.
No, but I guess they did prosecute her under the Witchcraft Act,
Yeah.
hence calling her that. But yeah, I don't think. Which it's not really what you'd expect if you said witch. You'd expect
No.
people around her to be getting ill and that kind of stuff because that's the bad connotation the witch that you kind of would expect with the Witchcraft Act.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of alarming that not once but twice she knew of ships that had been sunk before. I mean, even some of the Admiralty didn't know that they'd gone down by the time she had the information.
It's not like she was sat with a little Enigma machine in her back room telling her this information.
No, which begs the question, how did she know? Was she just guessing?
I mean, she'd be doing well to guess the exact shifts. It's impressive.
Right. I mean, obviously there were hundreds of seances, and this is only twice that we kind of have details that she found. Would be interesting to know whether there were other instances where she was completely wrong, and these two just stand out because she got lucky twice. If that makes sense. Like if we were gonna weigh all of the evidence,
It
if she made
almost
100 guesses and only two were right, it's easier to dismiss it. Whereas if she made 100 guesses and 98 were right,
I think it would have been really interesting if she'd been allowed to hold a séance as part of her evidence. Obviously, we'll never have known what would have happened because it didn't happen, but I think that would have been really, really interesting.
She obviously spooked a lot of sensible men to the point where they were like, okay, we're going to need to do something about this.
Yeah. But were they spooked because they thought maybe she was a spy? Or were they spooked because they genuinely thought that she could talk to the dead?
I mean, that's quite one of the big questions for this podcast, really.
It is.
Like, it sounds so simple, was she a witch? But there's so much to unpack within it.
Yeah.
And I mean, but it is interesting how could she have known that if even members of the Admiralty didn't know?
I would definitely be interested to hear everyone else's thoughts on it.
Yes, we'll be popping up a poll, so we definitely want to hear your thoughts on it. So coming next month, we have two posts on warrior women coming to the blog. We have a tangent on nostalgic movies, so you know we're going to be all up in the Princess Bride on that one.
100%.
We have patron exclusive After Dark on tattoos, a solving history on.
The Phantom of Texarkana, a serial killer that no one knows who they were.
Gonna need a therapy duck.
Potentially.
And a bonus podcast that's still to be decided. So until then, take care of yourselves and each other.